Thanks, Danielle. I apologize for not having submitted my paper to the Dropbox account. I don't know what we were thinking, planning a conference a week after the end of the semester. And thanks to all those people that did submit their paper. I started reading them. They were quite inspiring. Looking forward to the next 3 days. I think it will be a great conference. I had had in mind to write a quite technical paper, and a week or so ago, when I realized that I would not have time to submit it, I decided to change the focus of my paper a little bit to make it more interesting for a 15-minute talk as a starting point for this 3-day conference. So, I thought and wrote about cities quite a lot in the last few years. And doing that, I've spent most of my time trying to justify such an endeavor. Why should we political philosophers think about the city? But I've always hesitated to propose positive normative principles of urban justice. And I'll take the advantage of this event to give it a try. And I'll sketch this morning 3 principles of urban justice. 3 principles of urban justice that will be mainly concerned with determining what a resident in a city needs to have if she is to be treated fairly or with equal respect. Let me name these 3 principles up front. I don't like their names, but I count on you to give me better ideas. First principle is a principle of spatial equality. A second principle I call a voice principle, or the voice principle. And the third one is the exit principle. So principle of spatial equality, a voice principle, and an exit principle. I'm not going to give much content to these 3 principles. Instead, I take it as food for thought for the next few days. What is a theory of urban justice, or what should a theory of urban justice be concerned with? It seems to me that a proper theory of urban justice would have to deal with 2 sets of questions. The first set of questions concern the principles guiding the political and economic organizations of cities. So it can concern, for instance, the competitions between the various political jurisdiction of a city. Oh, by the way, here's a caveat. I will understand city here as the metropolitan region, with its multiple jurisdiction, including suburbs and, in some case, probably also exurbs. So you have this first set of questions which help us assessing the political, economic organizations of cities concerned with unfair competitions between the various political jurisdiction. And that kind of question propelled all sorts of proposals by urban thinkers and political theorists, for instance, in favor of an urban government. Ooh, and so you have Richard Dagger, for instance, that in political theory that proposed an ideal of an urban government whose jurisdiction is designed to fit perfectly the contour of the city, including its suburbs. Other people have done such proposals. In this conference, I take that they're not making such claims, but I take Hoy's paper on the debate between regionalist and localist, and Tad Williamson's paper on the city's right to capital to be mainly concerned with this first set of questions. But there are also questions about what it means for a resident in the city to be treated fairly or with equal respect, and this is the kind of questions I'm interested in. Of course, the questions are intertwined. Among proposals for an urban government, this type of questions encouraged all sorts of proposals, and among those, the emergence of the idea of an urban citizenship, a status any inhabitant of the urban public realm or the city should benefit, according to its proponents. So, as I said, these are obviously intertwined questions, but they are still distinct. We can ask what a resident of a city should benefit from, and then what would be the best institutional scheme to secure it. So, Reinhard Boberg, for instance, in his paper Reinventing Urban Citizenship, develops the notion of an urban citizenship, of course, based on residence, and envisions, following the proponents of regional or urban governments, that, I quote, social and political boundaries of cities ought to be broadly congruent, and that cities should be reunited with their peripheries in common jurisdiction. So these proposals, like those of Dagger or Boberg, are quite interesting, but to me they are all guilty of the same thing, that is, they're not taking the city seriously enough. They treat the city as a mini-state to which principles of social justice developed for the basic institutions of society should be directly applied. I don't think that's the way we should go. If we're going to say anything relevant at all about the city or about justice in the city, it is certainly not that people should have equal rights or a decent income or equal access to healthcare. We don't need to have the city in mind to make such claims. This is the task of a theory of social justice. So what a theory of urban justice should underline is the type of problems of justice that are specific to the urban context. And from that perspective, it seems to me that the most important thing to keep in mind is the spatial dimension of cities. This is a point Daniel made in his paper and in a recent article as well. And the idea goes somehow like that. A theory of social justice can, in principle, limit itself to the virtual space of rights and responsibilities of citizens, but a theory of urban justice cannot ignore the space shared by individuals within which they interact. So it is easy in the virtual perspective of theories of social justice to imagine in the abstract citizens with equal rights, opportunities, but questions of urban justice cannot be thought strictly in this fashion. Instead, what I see as the field of urban justice has first to do with questions of spatial relations that are all unequal by definition. And a normative reflection that would ignore this dimension would fail, it seems to me, to understand the peculiar or particular demands of urban justice. And from features of the city that have to do with its spatial dimension, I think we can derive at least three principles of urban justice. First principle, the one that I called principle of spatial equality, requires what? A fair access for the residents of the city to resources and services that are essential to pursue a conception of the good. Well, you'll say this is not proper to the city, right? Pursuing a conception of the good necessarily requires certain minimal resources, but in the urban context, in the city, it is an obvious, it's a trivial fact that access to services and resources is unequal, right? We don't all live next to a hospital, near to a police station, cultural institutions, and so on. Indeed, we are all, by definition, spatially unequal. Of course, public authorities are often preoccupied by access to public services, will make an effort to secure reasonable access to these services. But this doesn't only concern public services, but the provision of private goods as well. So one only has to think about access to decent foods in terms of quality, price. Well, you know the story. Too often people, poor people in cities don't have access to food of quality, fresh fruits, vegetables. And let's be blunt, they often have to pay more for their crap than the crap they get than people that are better off. Martin Blanchard in his text refers to the notion of food deserts. And I think this is a very serious question from the point of view of urban justice. This form of spatial inequality is very difficult to grasp or analyze in the virtual perspective of social justice. So to only talk about the type of resources one needs is not enough. We have to face spatial inequalities, and one task of a theory of urban justice, I take it, is to determine what counts as just and as unjust spatial inequalities. And this is the task of the principle of spatial equality. Of course, this claim is an easy one to make, but I think the task is a very challenging one, and I hope we'll be able to talk about it during this conference. Second, urban justice demands a particular type of democratic principle, a principle I'd like to call the voice principle by reference to the famous distinction of Albert Hirschman's between voice and exit. But this principle is not only a call, a simple call for participation in the political affairs of the city, even though I agree with Frank Cunningham that it is of utmost importance. This principle is the recognition of many other things. It is first, still following Daniel's paper, the recognition that the shared space in which urbanites live impose particular claims upon each other. I tried to make this point elsewhere in a paper by arguing that the city is essentially constituted by externalities or by the external effects that individuals constantly imposed upon each other. And I argued that trying to eliminate these external effects would be synonymous with trying to eliminate the city. It would represent a denial of the type of interaction that that define the urban environment. As a result, it is impossible to imagine the city if we take it seriously, an egalitarian ideal in which everyone would be compensated for costs that have been imposed upon them. And these external effects require constant democratic control. Which external effects do we accept? And which one do we reject is an essential question when it comes to the type of an environment we live in. But it is also, I thought it was a time thing. It is also the recognition that the organization of the city is part of who we are. I think Avner de Chalet is right to claim that the aim of justice within the city is to sustain the city's ethos. The city, and particularly in its spatial dimension, cannot be organized in a way that is neutral with respect to different conceptions of the good. The built environment, its aesthetic components, the type of housing favored, cannot be decided on neutral ground, and should not be decided on neutral ground. By definition, the way we plan our city will be partly perfectionist, as we say in political philosophy, or to quote Avner again, it has to be biased towards the community and its values, but this bias, and that's the end of quote, this bias should not be imposed, but should be determined democratically, and the voice principle is there to specify when it is. I was surprised to see, to read that in Avner's paper, since I developed this point in a very different way in a previous article called Are Cities Illiberal? I take it also that the idea of a right to the city can be understood as one possible interpretation of this principle, but we'll have the chance to discuss this notion in a more thorough way later, thanks to Lauren's paper. Finally, the need of a third principle that I called the exit principle comes from the polycentric form of the city. In other words, inequalities are amplified by the social and political fragmentation of the city, by the fact that it is divided among various formally independent municipal jurisdictions or separated neighborhoods. Of course, this feature of cities has been widely noted, most famously by Charles Thibaut, who argued that the possibility for individuals to vote with their feet, to move from one municipality to another, is actually what defines the city and distinguishes it from the nation state. And for Thibaut, this is the most promising feature of cities, or the market-driven cities. But one also has to realize that it is a feature of cities that can seriously, and that seriously, undermine social justice, notably by amplifying inequalities. Thibaut was optimistic about the fact that people would leave their community if it doesn't mirror their aspirations or their preference or their capacity to pay. But the fact is that for many people, exit is not even an option. And this is, for me, a case of injustice. A just city is one in which no one is stuck in their place. So it is necessary for an individual in the city to have a voice, or more strongly, a right to the city, as required by the second principle. It is nonetheless also necessary to have an exit option. I'm almost done. In the current state of affairs, the option of exit held by some is what in the end generates spatial segregation and what explains that others end up in ghettos that I define here as urban enclaves afflicted by poverty and offering very little opportunities to its residents, who for the most part don't have the resources to move out. And this goes to me, this goes, of course, contrary to a right to the city. Therefore, a just city has to secure an exit option for all its residents. Let me pass that. I'll just note in the end regarding this principle that this principle is not designed to prevent segregation, which is not in itself unjust, but what I called ghettoization. But it is also designed to secure a certain liberal ideal. If cities are not completely neutral, residents should have the possibility to leave their local community, municipal jurisdiction, or neighborhood, and choose a place that better fits with their own conception of the good. Of course, such a principle will have to be qualified. It is not to say that anyone should be able to live anywhere they want. Not everyone has a claim to a penthouse downtown. But I think the principle is nonetheless very important. So I had a short conclusion about the distinction I make between social justice and urban justice, but since I used my 15 minutes already, I'll just stop here. Thanks.
Thad Williamson, Subversive from University of Richmond. Okay, easy question. So what's the distinction between urban and social justice in your mind? Tell us what the distinction is between urban justice and social justice.
Well, the point I was going to make is that social justice is the concerns, questions that have to be dealt by the basic institutions of society. Question of socioeconomic equality, equal rights. What is concerned by the regulation of the market, obviously, as well. While urban justice concerns the type of questions that I presented in this paper, and what I wanted to insist on in the conclusion is that this is not to say that there are questions of social justice are not important for the city. Of course, city is probably the place where poverty is the most visible, and it is a task of a theory of social justice to fight it. Question of urban justice is the question of how the particular forms and norms of cities will undermine the task of basic institutions by, for instance, amplifying inequalities. since you asked the question and I was going to refer to the principle you defended as well in my conclusion, let me continue. Let me finish my conclusion. I was going to say I started the paper by saying that there are two types of questions that have to be asked. And I presented my answer to the first type of questions, and I still believe that we'll probably also need another set of principles of justice that have to do with the political and economic organization of cities. And among these principles, I believe that we'll certainly need, and our papers discuss that, we'll certainly need a principle of cooperation among municipal jurisdiction, but also probably something like the city's right to capital that Thad developed, or something along these lines. I don't think I share the details of the argument, but we'll be able to discuss it in another session. But I thought this paper was very interesting, and we certainly need something along these lines.
Wonderfully clear, and I really like the way you set it up, Patrick. You distinguish at the beginning between questions of political and economic organization and then questions, more philosophical questions, so what is urban justice? And so the idea is once we know what urban justice is, then we can start using that as guidelines for the economic and political. That makes a lot of sense. Of course, there's a reflexivity between these two things. With respect to a third category, however, the reflexivity seems to me to be especially prominent and kind of hard to, it makes it hard to divide, shave off from the from the questions of justice, and that is with respect to urban design. So, I mean, Dogger, for example, whom you referred to, finds himself, I get the feeling, reluctantly driven to new urbanism. And it's not that he likes it, it's just that he doesn't see any other way. And I'm just wondering if you want to speculate a little bit about the implications of all this for urban design, both methodologically, how do you separate out the question of urban design from what is justice, and also maybe even, in terms of application.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say two different things. The first thing I would say is that the way I see it, a theory of urban justice should not tell us what a good city is from the point of view of design. In the sense that I want to keep the ideal of a polycentric city, in which that would present many many different conceptions of the good design, if you want. That's why that's why you need an exit principle to make sure that you can go where you can choose a lifestyle, if you want, that would fit your preferences or your conceptions of good. But at the same time, and that's the most important thing, people in a community should decide for themselves the kind of community they want to live in, and therefore decide democratically the kind of zoning or design rules and regulation that would be prioritized in their local community. At the same time, I think that these principles will also constrain the type of of design that will be encouraged or allowed in the city, and most notably regarding the transit issue. If you think that the transit question is part of the urban design, then I think my principles will should be developed in a way that would encourage public transit, or at least ways to make sure that people are mobile, that is a consequence or an implication of the voice principle. Not the voice principle, the principle of spatial equality, and of the exit principle. What else? Yeah, I'll stop there, but maybe if you...
Okay, Avner. Avner de Shalit, Jerusalem. Thank you for your paper. Could you elaborate on the third principle? You said that the very fact that people cannot exit is not fair. And could you say more about it? And I guess one question would be, would you apply the same principle on the state level? Is it unfair that people cannot leave the state? And also, what's the source of this intuition? Is it an economic issue or a democratic issue or a community issue or what? Thank you.
On the third principle, the first part of the question is about why is it unfair for someone to be stuck in their place, and the second question is how do I justify it, and would it be the same thing for the state, right? The first part, if we are to talk at all about justice in cities, it seems to me that the idea of a ghetto or a place where people are stuck because of economic inequalities or racism in some cases, or is just obviously something we have to deal with, and I'd be curious to hear what you have in mind with this question. But maybe it will clarify if I get to the second part. In this paper that I referred to, Are Cities Liberal, I was actually starting, in order to justify perfectionism at the municipal level, I was starting with a Rawlsian framework and the idea of a closed society. So one of the reasons that a liberal philosopher like Rawls defends something, even though he's not really talking about that, but defends something like the principle of neutrality, is because he starts with this assumption of a closed system. We can't leave the state. It's, well, mostly an empirical fact that translates into a normative fact, but we cannot leave the state. And for that reason, we have to find a scheme of cooperation that would be acceptable to everyone. The city is different from that point of view. Well, you have the associations at the other end of the spectrum, which is where one assumes that there's a clear exit option, everyone can leave, and therefore an association is free to defend the kind of perfectionist principles that they want. Well, I see the city as some, or the municipality, or the neighborhood and municipal jurisdiction as being somewhere in between the continuum between the state and the free associations, and that's what justifies the legitimize perfectionist policies at this level. But again, if we try to justify perfectionism at this level, starting with a liberal framework, we have to make sure that there is an exit option available for all. So that was the idea.
I'm Clarissa Hayward from Washington University in St. Louis. And actually, my question was about the third principle as well. And I agree with you that this notion of like a marketplace of spaces and people voting with their feet can exacerbate inequalities. Is this working? Yeah, okay. But I was kind of puzzled by your solution being to allow everyone to exit, and especially given the caveat that everybody can't exit to exactly where they want to, it sort of made me think of school choice, which is that you have a choice except for all the good schools are taken, so you can't go there. And I wondered, like, my usual thinking about this problem would be to think about an institutional remedy that provides some kind of a constraint on the exit option for the privileged so that their fate is institutionally tied to that of those with few resources. So I think I'm nervous about this sort of free market solution. And I think there's a real difference. So I think a free market person would say to you, there's a real difference between saying you can't have racial discrimination, and they would agree with you. They'd say that's not a free market. But they'd say your freedom is to move where you'd like to move given your economic resources. So it seems like you want to say more than that, but I'm just worried about that direction. And I wonder if you could say, like, what would that mean? How would you actually enable people to exit without, if they didn't have money?
Thanks. Before I answer your question directly, I'll there's been some attempt to realize that principle. Just think about the dismantling of public housing in the States, the Gotro program in Chicago, which was in part disastrous because it kind of killed the community, and it's certainly not where I want to go. It's also not a free market. I don't see it as a free market solution, though. I was thinking about what would be the more concrete implications of all these principles. And one idea I have in mind when I think about this third principle, so when I think about what it would mean practically to have exit option, is would be to make sure that there are public housings or mixed housings in numerous neighborhoods that would allow for people to get out of a terrible situation. Some people think that this kind of principle should be only applied to and that might be correct. I'm still not sure about that, but some people think that it should only be applied to the worst stuff. So it would be somehow a spatial principle of difference, or a spatial difference principle, like an application of Rawls to. I'm not sure about that, but I think we can find ways to make it more practical. So public housing is one way of seeing it.
Hello, Peggy Cohn, University of Toronto. I wanted to ask a little bit more about your first principle, spatial equality. I hope I got this correct in my notes, because I know the exact wording is very important, but I think you defined it as fair access to resources to pursue a concept of the good. But when you use the term fair, it seems sort of...
I should have probably said fair spatial access, but...
Okay, so... The use of the word fair seems a little tautological, because then the question is, what is fair? And as I'm sure you're familiar with, there's been an extensive debate in Anglo-American political philosophy about how we should approach something like equality. Is it through sufficientarianism? Is it through equality of resources, equality of opportunity? But it seems to me, looking at this from this perspective of cities or spatial justice, might illuminate some of those debates. So I was wondering if looking at what we need to get justice in cities tells us anything about justice in general, and which of those principles perhaps is more compelling to us. But the second part of my question is then, when we take the next step and apply these general abstract principles of equality to cities, whether or not they are adequate, whether we need a specifically spatial conception. And what I have here in mind is someone like Ronald Dworkin, who argues that the benefit of a resources-based perspective is it does allow people to calculate these trade-offs between different goods that they wish to pursue. And is that in fact true? Would that solve the problem of justice in cities? So if everybody did have equality of resources, not just fair access, but actual equality of resources, then couldn't they decide whether maybe they wanted to live in a food ghetto because they had access to green space and they were perhaps in a rural area, more rural area where there were other benefits, or maybe they didn't have access to low-priced supermarkets, but there were ethnic businesses. And so, in fact, that there would be some trade-offs in terms of space, but if people have equal resources, they could make those. Do we need a specifically spatial conception?
Can't answer the first question. It's actually very interesting, but I haven't thought of it, and I'm really not sure what I would say. And I would really be happy to hear what you have in mind on that. The second question is a very difficult one, and it might be the case that. So one question we have to ask when it comes to developing a theory of urban justice is something like that. Can a society be perfectly just by virtue of having just basic institutions? Once you have just basic institutions and you can a just point of departure, like Dworkin's resource-based metaphor, do you have a just society, or is that possible that even with just basic institutions, some sub-institutions in society can create problems of justice of their own? And I think we will have to, if we want to develop a theory of urban justice, we have to make the point that that there is this possibility that some institutions, some social institutions within society, can undermine social justice, notably by amplifying inequalities, even though the basic institutions of society are perfectly just. But I'm still aware that I might not be able to bring this this argument to an end, if you want. So I'm still not. Still trying to think through this issue.
Thank you. I'm Chris Bourne, a PhD student at the University of Montreal, and I think this falls mostly into your second principle, the voice principle. I'm particularly interested in your I believe you phrased it, the democratic determination of the urban ethos. And a couple of questions about that. What might that look like? Is it simply sort of aggregative elections, or is there something more deliberative at play? And at the same time, are any of your principles up for grabs in that democratic deliberation? Can people decide that, no, we don't really want, we like our community the way it is, we don't want anybody to be able to leave, or, you know, something like that. But I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, I used Avner's term with ethos. That's not one that I had used before, but I just wanted to take advantage of all the papers in this conference I'm not sure where I would go with that word, but this is a good question. I don't think that I think that the idea of a perfectionist municipality doesn't mean that people in their community can do whatever they want. I still think that cities, municipalities are part of a larger structure with basic institutions that have to secure justice within cities, and therefore these principles that I propose should be secured by these basic institutions, even though they are not principles for basic institutions, right? So the idea of perfectionist municipalities is not the idea of a municipality where citizens can gather and decide to live in a Catholic or in an Aristotelian town, or it concerns only a certain subset of questions, not political questions, but questions like that of the built environment, that's an example. But it's very important for me to make sure that it's a very limited perfectionism that I have in mind.
Lauren King, Wilfrid Laurier University. I too am fascinated by this third principle, and this what I heard is this sort of hint of almost like a moral and aesthetic polycentricity and a kind of moral Thibault model where you know, within these constraints of base, you know, some overarching basic justice, we would have these jurisdictions that, that we could move among. And I, but like Peggy, I was sort of thinking of some of these egalitarian puzzles, and Dworkin, sort of a lesser known piece, but has this famous article on the checkerboard problem. If you have jurisdictions that, that can interpret, you know, fundamental rights in different ways, and how do we have a kind of equality of access if we have to traverse a checkerboard where, no, actually you're in this jurisdiction, it's horribly illegal what you're doing, but if you're on the way to this jurisdiction. And so I wondered if there's a variation of the problem of expensive tastes in that some moving to some jurisdictions and having, you know, considered judgments and values that push me towards that jurisdiction, some of them are going to involve externalities that you know, are more onerous than others. And so if I want a lot of green space and other people want compact, dense, multi-use, Jacobian, you know, urban neighborhoods, we have a problem because everything's got to be done somewhere and you can only do so many things in that place. And so I wonder, again, I guess a sort of a variation on Peggy's question, how do you grapple with those sorts of problems that arise out of the very externalities that you think characterize the urban setting?
This is a principle that has to be qualified, and I'm not sure exactly how we will qualify it, but it's certainly a challenge. I think that sprawl is quite a problem for cities, and even though I want people to move in the type of community they feel they like, I don't want to promote more sprawl, and that principle might be here. Might have to be here qualified by a principle regarding the political and economic organization of city. That's one thing. The other thing about the expensive taste problem regards another type of qualification we need for this for this principle. And once again, I'm not exactly sure how we should we should make it, but. The idea is certainly not to have the society pay for people that want to live downtown or in a penthouse in a penthouse on the 50th floor. So that's certainly not the idea. It's a much more, once again, limited minimal principle that that is there to make sure not that that people live exactly where they want to live, but that but two things: that their freedom is not completely violated by certain perfectionist principles, and even there I'm not sure, but mostly that people are not stuck in place. That's really the most important part of this principle.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick.